Hello, you are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. All past episodes can be found at RiverWest. No, I can't. All past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. Okay, so as typically is the case, I haven't had a whole lot of time this week to do my own researched episode. I really want to do an episode just called Communism. That'll talk more about communism and what it actually is and what it certainly isn't, which I've been kind of doing with the episodes on syndicalism and the episode on socialism. So this week's episode, we are going to go back to an ongoing series that I've quite been enjoying called the Anarchist Book Corner. Let's see, the last time that we read something by somebody else was just a few episodes ago, episode 57. It was an essay by David Graeber called Hope in Common. Well, surprise, surprise, David Graeber is back on our radar, and he's written a new essay which came out somewhat recently, first published in the New York Review of Books. The new essay is called Against Economics by David Graeber. We're going to see if we can read it really quick. If we don't get through the whole thing in its entirety today, that's fine. We can do it. We can finish it up next week, and then we can kind of talk about what I thought of it. I always say we. Man, I'd love to have other people on this show, and eventually I will, but yeah, for now it's just me chatting at you. Okay, so here we go. Against Economics by David Graeber. There is a growing feeling among those who have the responsibility of managing large economies that the discipline of economics is no longer fit for purpose. It is beginning to look like a science designed to solve problems that no longer exist. A good example is the obsession with inflation. Economists still teach their students that the primary economic role of government, many would insist its only really proper economic role, is to guarantee price stability. We must be constantly vigilant over the dangers of inflation. For governments to simply print money is therefore inherently sinful. If, however, inflation is kept at bay through the coordinated action of government and central bankers, the market should find its quote-unquote natural rate of unemployment. And investors taking advantage of clear price signals should be able to ensure healthy growth. These assumptions came with the monetarism of the 1980s, the idea that government should restrict itself to managing the money supply, and by the 1990s had come to be accepted as such elementary common sense that pretty much all political debate had to set out from a ritual acknowledgement of the perils of government spending. This continues to be the case. Despite the fact that, since the 2008 recession, central banks have been printing money frantically in an attempt to create inflation and compel the rich to do something useful with their money, and have been largely unsuccessful in both endeavors. We now live in a different economic universe than we did before the crash. Falling unemployment no longer drives up wages. Printing money does not cause inflation. Yet, the language of public debate and the wisdom conveyed in economic textbooks remain almost entirely unchanged. One expects a certain institutional lag. Mainstream economists nowadays might not be particularly good at predicting financial crashes, facilitating general prosperity, or coming up with the models for preventing climate change. But when it comes to establishing themselves in positions of intellectual authority, unaffected by such failings, their success is unparalleled. One would have to look at the history of religions to find anything like it. To this day, Economics continues to be taught not as a story of arguments, not like any other social science, as a welter of often warring theoretical perspectives, but rather as something more like physics, the gradual realization of universal, unimpeachable mathematical truths. Quote unquote, heterodox theories of economics do, of course, exist. Institutionalist, Marxist, feminist, Austrian, post-Keynesian, etc. But their exponents have been almost completely locked out of what are considered serious departments, and even outright rebellions by economic students, from the post-autistic economics movement in France to post-crash economics in Britain, have largely failed to force them into the core curriculum. As a result, heterodox economists continue to be treated as just a step or two away from crackpots, despite the fact that they often have a much better record of predicting real-world economic events. What's more, the basic psychological assumptions on which mainstream neoclassical economics is based, though they have long since been disproved by actual psychologists, have colonized the rest of the academy and have had a profound impact on popular understanding of the world. Nowhere is this divide between public debate and economic reality more dramatic than in Britain, which is perhaps why it appears to be the first country where something is beginning to crack. It was center-left New Labour that presided over the pre-crash bubble, and voters' throw-the-bastards-out reaction brought a series of conservative governments that soon discovered that a rhetoric of austerity, the Churchillian evocation of common sacrifice for the public good, played well with the British public, allowing them to win broad popular acceptance for policies designed to pare down what little remained of the British welfare state and redistribute resources upward toward the rich. Quote, there is no magic money tree, unquote, as Theresa May put it during the snap election of 2017, virtually the only memorable line from one of the most lackluster campaigns in British history. The phrase has been repeated endlessly in the media. Whenever someone asks why the UK is the only country in Western Europe that charges university tuition, or whether it is really necessary to have quite so many people sleeping on the streets. The truly extraordinary thing about May's phrase is that it isn't true. There are plenty of magic money trees in Britain, as there are in any developed economy. They are called banks. Since modern money is simply credit, banks can and do create money literally out of nothing, simply by making loans. Almost all of the money circulating in Britain at the moment is bank-created in this way. Not only is the public largely unaware of this, but a recent survey by the British research group Positive Money discovered that an astounding 85% of members of Parliament had no idea where money really came from. Most appeared to be under the impression that it was produced by the Royal Mint. Economists, for obvious reasons, can't be completely oblivious to the role of banks, but they have spent much of the 20th century arguing about what actually happens when someone applies for a loan. One school insists that banks transfer existing funds from their reserves. Another that they produce new money, but only on the basis of a multiplier effect, so that your car loan can still be seen as ultimately rooted in some retired grandmother's pension fund. Only a minority, mostly heterodox economists, post-Keynesians, and modern money theorists, uphold what is called the, quote, credit creation theory of banking, unquote, that bankers simply wave a magic wand and make the money appear, secure in the confidence that even if they hand a client a credit for $1 million, ultimately the recipient will put it back in the bank again, so that, across the system as a whole, credits and debts will cancel out. Rather than loans being based in deposits, in this view, deposits themselves were the result of loans. The one thing it never seemed to occur to anyone to do was to get a job at a bank and find out what actually happens when someone asks to borrow money. In 2014, a German economist named Richard Werner did exactly that, and discovered that, in fact, loan officers do not check their existing funds, reserves, or anything else. They simply create money out of thin air, or as he preferred to put it, fairy dust. That year also appears to have been when elements in Britain's notoriously independent civil service decided that enough was enough. The question of money creation became a critical bone of contention. The overwhelming majority of even mainstream economists in the UK had long since rejected austerity as counterproductive. which predictably had almost no impact on public debate. But at a certain point, demanding that the technocrats charged with running the system base all policy decisions on false assumptions about something as elementary as the nature of money becomes a little like demanding that architects proceed on the understanding that the square root of 47 is actually pi. Architects are aware that buildings would start falling down. People would die. Before long, the Bank of England, the British equivalent of the Federal Reserve, whose economists are most free to speak their minds since they are not formally part of the government, rolled out an elaborate official report called Money Creation in the Modern Economy, replete with videos and animations, making the same point. Existing economics textbooks, and particularly the reigning monetarist orthodoxy, are wrong. The heterodox economists are right. Private banks create money. Central banks, like the Bank of England, create money as well. But monetarists are entirely wrong to insist that their proper function is to control the money supply. In fact, central banks do not in any sense control the money supply. Their main function is to set the interest rate, to determine how much private banks can charge for the money they create. Almost all public debate on these subjects is thereof based on false premises. For example, if what the Bank of England was saying were true, government borrowing didn't divert funds from the private sector. It created entirely new money that had not existed before. One might have imagined that such an admission would create something of a splash, and in certain restricted circles it did. Central banks in Norway, Switzerland, and Germany quickly put out similar papers. Back in the UK, the immediate media response was simply silence. The Bank of England report has never, to my knowledge, been so much as mentioned on the BBC or any other TV news outlet. Newspaper columnists continued to write as if monetarism was self-evidently correct. Politicians continued to be grilled about where they would find the cash for social programs. It was as if a kind of entente cordiale had been established, in which the technocrats would be allowed to live in one theoretical universe, while politicians and news commenters would continue to exist in an entirely different one. Still, there are signs that this arrangement is temporary. England, and the Bank of England in particular, prides itself on being a bellwether for global economic trends. Monetarism is itself got its launch into intellectual respectability in the 1970s after having been embraced by Bank of England economists. From there, it was ultimately adopted by the insurgent Thatcher regime, and only after that by Ronald Reagan in the United States, and it was subsequently exported almost everywhere else. It is possible that a similar pattern is reproducing itself today. In 2015, a year after the appearance of the Bank of England report, the Labour Party, for the first time, allowed open elections for its leadership, and the left wing of the party, under Jeremy Corbyn and now Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer John McDonnell, took hold of the reins of power. At the time, the Labour left were considered even more marginal extremists than was Thatcher's wing of the Conservative Party in 1975. It is also, despite the media's constant efforts to paint them as unreconstructed 1970s socialists, the only major political group in the UK that has been open to new economic ideas. While pretty much the entire political establishment has been spending most of its time these last few years screaming at one another about Brexit, McDonnell's office and Labour youth support groups have been holding workshops and floating policy initiatives on everything from a four-day work week and universal basic income to a green industrial revolution and, quote, fully automated luxury communism, unquote, and inviting heterodox economists to take part in popular education initiatives aimed at transforming conceptions of how the economy really works. Corbynism has faced near histrionic opposition from virtually all sectors of the political establishment, but it would be unwise to ignore the possibility that something historic is afoot. One sign that something historically new has indeed appeared is if scholars begin reading the past in a new light. Accordingly, one of the most significant books to come out of the UK in recent years would have to be Robert Skidelsky's Money and Government, The Past and Future of Economics. ostensibly an attempt to answer the question of why mainstream economics rendered itself so useless in the years immediately before and after the crisis of 2008, it is really an attempt to retell the history of the economic discipline through a consideration of the two things, money and government, that most economists least like to talk about. Skidelsky is well positioned to tell this story. He embodies a uniquely English type, the gentle maverick, so firmly ensconced in the establishment that it never occurs to him that he might not be able to say exactly what he thinks, and whose views are tolerated by the rest of the establishment precisely for that reason. Born in Manchuria, trained at Oxford, professor of political economy at Warwick, Skidelsky is best known as the author of the definitive three-volume biography of John Maynard Keynes, and has for the last three decades sat in the House of Lords as Baron of Tilton, affiliated at different times with a variety of political parties, and sometimes none at all. During the early Blair years, he was a conservative, and even served as opposition spokesman on economic matters in the upper chamber. Currently, he's a crossbench independent, broadly aligned with left labor. In other words, he follows his own flag. Usually, it's an interesting flag. Over the last several years, Skidelsky has been taking advantage of his position in the world's most elite legislative body to hold a series of high-level seminars on the reformation of the economic discipline. This book is, in a sense, the first major product of these endeavors. What it reveals is an endless war between two broad theoretical perspectives in which the same side always seems to win. For reasons that rarely have anything to do with either theoretical sophistication or greater predictive power. The crux of the argument always seems to turn on the nature of money. Is money best conceived of as a physical commodity, a precious substance used to facilitate exchange? Or is it better to see money primarily as a credit, a bookkeeping method, or circulating IOU, in any case a social arrangement? This is an arrangement that has been going on in some form for thousands of years. What we call money is always a mixture of both, and, as I myself noted in Debt, published in 2011, the center of gravity between the two tends to shift back and forth over time. In the Middle Ages, everyday transactions across Eurasia were typically conducted by means of credit, and money was assumed to be an abstraction. It was the rise of global European empires in the 16th and 17th centuries and the corresponding flood of gold and silver looted from the Americas that really shifted perceptions. Historically, the feeling that bullion actually is money tends to mark periods of generalized violence, mass slavery, and predatory standing armies, which for most of the world was precisely how the Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, French, and British empires were experienced. One important theoretical innovation that these new bullion-based theories of money allowed was, as Skidelsky notes, what has come to be called the quantity theory of money, usually referred to in textbooks, since economists take endless delight in abbreviations, as QTM. The QTM argument was first put forward by a French lawyer named Jean Bodin during a debate over the cause of the sharp, destabilizing price inflation that immediately followed the Iberian conquest of the Americas. Bodin argued that the inflation was a simple matter of supply and demand. The enormous influx of gold and silver from the Spanish colonies was cheapening the value of money in Europe. The basic principle would no doubt have seemed a matter of common sense to anyone with experience of commerce at the time, but it turns out to have been based on a series of false assumptions. For one thing, most of the gold and silver extracted from Mexico and Peru did not end up in Europe at all, and certainly wasn't coined into money. Most of it was transported directly to China and India to buy spices, silks, calicoes, and other Oriental luxuries, quote unquote. And insofar as it had inflationary effects back home, it was on the basis of speculative bonds of one sort or another. This almost always turns out to be true when QTM is applied. It seems self-evident, but only if you leave most of the critical factors out. In the case of the 16th century price inflation, for instance, once one takes account of credit, hoarding and speculation, not to mention increased rates of economic activity, investment in new technology, and wage levels, which in turn have a lot to do with the relative power of workers and employers, creditors and debtors, it becomes impossible to say for certain which is the deciding factor, whether the money supply drives prices or prices drive the money supply. Technically, this comes down to a choice between what are called exogenous and endogenous theories of money. Should money be treated as an outside factor, like all those Spanish doubloons supposedly sweeping into Antwerp, Dublin, and Genoa in the days of Philip II, or should it be imagined primarily as a product of economic activity itself, mined, minted, put into circulation, or more often created as credit instruments, such as loans, in order to meet a demand, which of course mean that the roots of inflation lie elsewhere? To put it bluntly, QTM is obviously wrong. Doubling the amount of gold in a country will have no effect on the price of cheese if you give all the gold to rich people and they just bury it in their yards, or use it to make gold-plated submarines. This is incidentally why quantitative easing, the strategy of buying long-term government bonds to put money into circulation, did not work either. What actually matters is spending. Nonetheless, from Baudin's time to the present, almost every time there was a major policy debate, the QTM advocates won. In England, the pattern was set in 1696, just after the creation of the Bank of England, with an argument over wartime inflation between Treasury Secretary William Lowndes, Sir Isaac Newton, then Warden of the Mint, and the philosopher John Locke. Newton had agreed with the Treasury that silver coins had to be officially devalued to prevent a deflationary collapse. Locke took an extreme monetarist position, arguing that the government should be limited to guaranteeing the value of property, including coins, and that tinkering would confuse investors and defraud creditors. Locke won. The result was deflationary collapse. A sharp tightening of the money supply created an abrupt economic contradiction that threw hundreds of thousands out of work and created mass penury, riots, and hunger. The government quickly moved to moderate the policy, first by allowing banks to monetize government war debts in the form of banknotes, and eventually by moving off the silver standard entirely. But in its official rhetoric, Locke's small government pro-creditor hard money ideology became the grounds of all further political debate. According to Skidelsky, the pattern was to repeat itself again and again in 1797, the 1840s, the 1890s, and ultimately the late 1970s and early 1980s, with Thatcher and Reagan's, in each case brief, adoption of monetarism. Although always we see the same sequence of events. 1. The government adopts hard money policies as a matter of principle. 2. Disaster ensues. 3. The government quietly abandons hard money policies. 4. The economy recovers. 5. Hard money philosophy nonetheless becomes or is reinforced as simple universal common sense. How was it possible to justify such a remarkable string of failures? Here, a lot of the blame, according to Skidelsky, can be laid at the feet of the Scottish philosopher David Hume. An early advocate of QTM, Hume was also the first to introduce the notion that short-term shocks, such as Locke produced, would create long-term benefits if they had the effect of unleashing the self-regulating powers of the market. Ever since Hume, economists have distinguished between the short-run and the long-run effects of economic change, including the effects of policy interventions. The distinction has served to protect the theory of equilibrium by enabling it to be stated in a form which took some account of reality. In economics, the short-run now typically stands for the period during which a market, or any economy of markets, temporarily deviates from its long-term equilibrium position under the impact of some shock, like a pendulum temporarily dislodged from a position of rest. This way of thinking suggests that governments should leave it to markets to discover their natural equilibrium positions. Government interventions to quote-unquote correct deviations will only add extra layers of delusion to the original one. There is a logical flaw to any such theory. There's no possible way to disprove it. The premise that markets will always right themselves in the end can only be tested if one has a commonly agreed definition of what the end is. But for economists, that definition turns out to be, quote, however long it takes to reach a point where I can say the economy has returned to equilibrium, unquote. In the same way, statements like the barbarians always win in the end or truth always prevails cannot be proved wrong, since in practice they just mean whenever barbarians win or truths prevail, I shall declare the story over. At this point, all the pieces were in place. Tight money policies, which benefited creditors and the wealthy, could be justified as harsh medicine to clear up price signals so the market could return to a healthy state of long-run balance. In describing how all this came about, Skidelsky is providing us with a worthy extension of a history Carl Polanyi first began to map out in the 1940s. The story of how supposedly self-regulating national markets were the product of careful social engineering. Part of that involved creating government policies self-consciously designed to inspire resentment of quote-unquote big government. Skidelsky writes, a crucial innovation was income tax, first levied in 1814 and renewed by Prime Minister Robert Peel in 1842. By 1911 to 1914, this had become the principal source of government revenue. Income tax had the double benefit of giving the British state a secure revenue base and aligning voters' interests with cheap government, since only direct taxpayers had the vote. Fiscal probity under Gladstone became the new morality. In fact, there's absolutely no reason a modern state should fund itself primarily by appropriating a portion of each citizen's earnings. There are plenty of other ways to go about it. Many, such as land, wealth, commercial or consumer taxes, any of which can be made more or less progressive, are considerably more efficient. Since creating a bureaucratic apparatus capable of monitoring citizens' personal affairs to the degree required by an income tax system is itself enormously expensive. But this misses the real point. Income tax is supposed to be intrusive and exasperating. It is meant to feel at least a little bit unfair. Like so much of classical liberalism and contemporary neoliberalism, it is an ingenious political sleight of hand, an expansion of the bureaucratic state that also allows its leaders to pretend to advocate for small government. The one major exception to this pattern was the mid-20th century, what has come to be remembered as the Keynesian Age. It was a period in which those running capitalist democracies, spooked by the Russian Revolution and the prospect of the mass rebellion of their own working classes, allowed unprecedented levels of redistribution, which in turn led to the most generalized material prosperity in human history. The story of the Keynesian Revolution of the 1930s and the neoclassical counter-revolution of the 1970s has been told innumerable times, but Skidelsky gives the reader a fresh sense of the underlying conflict. Keynes himself was a staunch anti-communist, but largely because he felt that capitalism was more likely to drive rapid technological advance that would largely eliminate the need for material labor. He wished for full employment, not because he thought work was good, but because he ultimately wished to do away with work, envisioning a society in which technology would render human labor obsolete. In other words, he assumed that the ground was always shifting under the analyst's feet. The object of any social science was inherently unstable. Max Weber, for similar reasons, argued that it would never be possible for social scientists to come up with anything remotely like the laws of physics, because by the time they had come anywhere near to gathering enough information, society itself and what analysts felt was important to know about it would have changed so much that the information would be irrelevant. Keynes's opponents, on the other hand, were determined to root their arguments in just such universal principles. Okay, we're gonna have to end it there for now and finish this essay next week. It's obviously a book review by David Graeber, reviewing Money and Government, The Past and Future of Economics by Robert Skidelsky. We'll finish it next week and discuss. We'll also talk about concepts like freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes of this show can be found on creamcitymedia.com/anti. Stay tuned to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM. There's a lot of great stuff coming up. You're not going to want to miss it.